You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. My guest for episode 254 is Teddy Thompson, son of the famed folk duo Richard and Linda Thompson. He started out playing in his father's band, but released his first solo album in 2000. Right now hearing Into My Arms from 2008's A Piece of What You Need, perhaps his biggest hit. That was his fourth album. We'll be discussing the song Come Back from Never Be the Same, his brand new 10th solo album. Now, a couple of these albums have been duets, with one with Kelly Jones, one with Jenny Amaldar. He writes a lot of originals, of course, but he also enjoys covers, classic country, old-time rock. There's also an album from 2014 that he initiated, attributed just to Thompson, which is him and his parents and his siblings and in-laws, etc. So he has been a guest on their albums, among other people's. We'll also be discussing Move at Speed from Heartbreaker Please from 2020 and I Should Get Up from 2006's Separate Ways. We'll conclude by listening to So This Is Heartache, also from the new album. For more information, please see teddythompson.net. For more at this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to support the effort and get an ad-free experience with my detailed episode notes, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of In My Arms from A Piece of What You Need, 2008, maybe your biggest hit, according to the download numbers. We're going to get pretty quickly to the new album. Can we sum up the arc of the career, right? I know you were in your dad's band, and then your first solo album, and then there was kind of a gap we'll talk about for the second album, and then you've got a pretty steady stream. Any thought about the arc of the direction and where you're at before we hear the new song?
I think I tend to disappear for periods of time, which is sort of true to my personality. So I wouldn't say I'm very consistent, but yeah, that sounds about right. My dad employed me as a little sort of, you know, helped me learn a few things, which was helpful. Mostly don't be in your dad's band. No, I kid. I jest. And then I started and here I am continuing.
Well, and it seems the last couple of things before the new album are focusing on country music and covers and things, you know, I mean, does that seem right that it's been the 6 years since your sort of proper solo album in the mode of your early stuff?
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I'm always surprised when this happens, you know, there tends to be a long gap between some of my records and I'm surprised how long that gap is. I mean, I can't believe it's been 6 years. It doesn't feel like it. I don't know what I've been doing.
The pandemic? It's, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good excuse. But I loved the pandemic. I had a great time doing nothing. I'm big on doing nothing. I'm one of those. So yeah, I can't really blame. It wasn't that different from my regular life. But yeah, I did delve into the country music thing. And yeah, it was kind of prompted by the pandemic and not having that much to say myself, i.e. not having a whole load of songs that were ready to go, but wanting to do something to get off the sofa and make some music. And I really grew up loving country music, and that was the most obvious thing for me to dip into.
Well, and of course, we have traces of that in the new album. Yes, can you say a little before we hear it in full about where you're at with this new album, Never Be the Same, and the song you picked, in particular, the opening track, Come Back?
I would like everybody who's ever left me to come back, really, but just briefly, to tell me how much they love and miss me and how I was the most important person in their life, and then maybe just go away again after that. That's the gist of that song.
I hope you've had some time to get on with yourself and figure out what's going on. I know you needed space to be all by yourself, or was it with some other one? Now can you come back? That who you are right now how can you come back? Can you come back to me? Can you come back? Can you come back to me?
The reason I picked this and the second tune, Move at Speed, is because you do little things with the tempo that you add in an extra beat. We actually grind to a stop before we go to the chorus, sort of like to make it extra dramatic. Any thought about this general shape here?
I wouldn't say I'm one of those writers who tries to contrive these things in the writing of the song. It's usually comes fairly naturally, organically. And then the real emphasis of these things and the real mapping out of different sections of the song and trying to do some interesting things comes in the making of the record. So a lot of that happens in the studio. Some of it you have these vague ideas in your head. But so I give a lot of credit to the great David Mansfield, who produced this record, who made a lot of these moments impactful, which is what good producers do. So yes, there is the big stop, and then it's a pretty big shift in attitude in the song there, and so in what I'm trying to convey. So it makes sense to have a shift in feel. There is even like a dropped bar in the choruses where it's, you know, you lose, there's like a bar of three a couple of times in a 4/4 song to sort of make things more immediate as well.
Well, yeah, I guess it's more as if the kick drum hits are an answering voice, because if you were just sticking a 4/4, it'd be come back, bam, won't you, because the can you is the four, but you just want to have those two hits there before we proceed.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's blame the drummer.
So that was not in your original demo? You had it straight 4/4 the whole time in your demo, or did you even demo these?
I think I had it like that. Yeah, it's hard to remember.
Are you recording demos on your own, on your phone? Like, what actually goes to the producer when you actually... And was this produced entirely in a room with David, or was this you guys sending tracks back and forth at this point?
It was done entirely in the room with David, and I do not record anything at home. I'm not technically minded. I don't really like one day I might have to give in, but so far I've held out. I don't really like having that option around. I quite like separating the writing and the recording and sort of saving it all up for, you know, the big day in the studio with all the real musicians and doing it together. But so all I really do is make demos on my iPhone as I go along. And then as the recording becomes, it's a deadline too, is what I like about it. So, you know, there's, you book that time in the studio and you're under pressure whenever that is. It's a month away, it's 6 weeks away, maybe it's 3 months away. And then as it gets closer, you know, you have to finish the songs and you have to do a complete rough demo on your phone for the producer so that it's a complete song. It can't really turn up with half finished things, not in this day and age when time is precious and expensive and budgets are small. So yeah, it goes like that. And then the, what Dave and I did actually is I did go in there and just, we sat down and made acoustic demos of everything before the tracking session so that we had slightly better quality. And we talked a little bit about arrangements and what to do. And then we just, you know, left. Then we just did it old school. We had the drummer and the bass player come in, and we all, those two and David and I, played all the songs together live, but separated, you know, and then built from there.
So are you sticking on this song to acoustic and David's covering the electrics, or are you overdubbing some of that yourself?
I think he ended up playing everything, because the reality of tracking in that fashion is that you really ideally want the vocal to be on its own, i.e. without acoustic guitar in it. For a song like that, especially, has a lot of dynamics. Otherwise, you have too much bleed going on. So I think most of the time, and I think definitely with that song, he played acoustic when we tracked. So it was bass, drums, and acoustic guitar, and just me singing. And then we overdubbed from there.
And then he's adding all the keyboard. You have a lot of analog synth on this. And, you know, these strange 80s sort of sounds that come in here. Is that just his sensibility, or is that something you requested?
That actually is not David. So that was something that we did towards the end, which I had in the back of my mind. It's a great friend of mine and a great musician named John Grant, who is... apart from being a wonderful singer-songwriter, is a synth wizard and aficionado. And I had that sound in my mind for a few songs, and I was, David and I were talking, and I said, you know, I really am looking for someone who can do a kind of John Grant thing. It turns out he's the only one that can do the John Grant thing. But luckily enough, I have his number, and I asked him, and he was very kind to do it for me. And yeah, I'm really thrilled by that aspect of the sound.
And in that case, is it you sending it to him? I don't know what city you guys, okay.
Yes, that was, he lives in Reykjavik, so that was, it was not an option to go over there. Well, not really.
Sure. And is he just sending you one thing and you're just, that's perfect just the way it is? Or is it, here's some options? Or is it you and David digitally moving things around and cutting out notes? And
for the most part, I was like 90% of it was just what he did was great. Mm-hmm. And which is a little bit of an unknown, a little bit of a, it's not really a risk, but there's just the chance, because we hadn't really worked on very much music together, but we know each other well. And I just was pretty sure that we had the same kind of sensibilities, and that what he did is something I would like, because I'm such a big fan of his music. And, you know, the only risk is like, what if you don't like it? Then it's like, gosh, you know, wouldn't that be a
well, then you
awkward?
Use a little bit of it. And you
We've all been in that situation. Like, oh no, my friend did all this stuff and I thought I was going to like it. But no, I'm pleased to say that he just was just as amazing as I hoped he would be. And yeah, 90% of it was just like David and I played what he sent and we were just like, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. That's amazing. And then there were a couple of things that we tweaked a little bit and a couple of things that I think we moved a little bit. There was no great surgery going on. It was just like almost all amazing.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking the synth solo, which then sort of as if you were halfway through the verse, I guess, becomes a dual electric guitar solo. Had you done the guitars first and you sent them, you know, so he knew what he had to fill.
Yes. And the tracks were pretty complete by the time we sent them to John. And there was, you know, there were a couple of notes. That was one of them, like, hey, take the first half of that solo. So, you know, he wasn't flying blind arrangement-wise. He knew what we were looking for, what areas we wanted him to play in. And then it was just a question of, you know, do your thing.
Well, that's amazing that you had what, you know, could have been a completed chorus without this trumpet-like... It's really prominent what he's doing. Come back, you know, kind of this sweeping up and down. Obviously, you used it, but that's probably not the sound that you, again, were you singing that part
didn't exist. I mean, that was created by John. In a way, I know what you're saying, you know, as somebody who, when you make records, it is sort of wild to think like, but how could you have not had that in there? Or, you know, how could you have not sort of heard that? But it happens throughout the process. It's kind of amazing. And then when you finish it, you think, wow, I didn't have that in mind, but I can't imagine the song without it now. It's wild.
Actually, I'm forgetting now. Let me play a little bit of the chorus so I can remember exactly where, whether it's in the gap or whether it's in unison with the vocal here.
Can you come back? Can you come back?
Okay, but it's sustaining into the kick drum a little bit, because I could see the original notion being we're playing this and then everything focuses on those two kick drum hits, whereas, you know, I guess there's just more atmosphere over it now. Yeah, you have another song on here, Not What I Need, where you kind of like the stop before the chorus here, but what it's the, I should have told you days ago. And then you like just stop the whole song as if to correct yourself, being willing to put these gestures that keep there from being just a steady beat. I find it interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously a lyric, you know, in the lyric there. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be that I always had that in mind. Wouldn't it be fun to sort of have it stop like you're, as you say, correcting it yourself, but the whole band is doing it with you or has to follow you. So that's obviously a device that was intentional. It's something I was enamored by trying.
The rest of the band, Charlie Drayton on drums, Tony Shear on bass. I haven't seen the liner notes to your other albums. Are those your people from past projects or were these David's? What is the history of this collaboration?
First of all, both of them are on the country album before this that David and I did, My Love of Country. Tony Shear, I've worked with a lot. He's a New York guy who I've known for a long time, who's amazing. And so he's been on a few things. He actually was on, I think, my second record in 2005, playing some guitar. So I've known him for a long, long time, 20 years. Charlie Drayton more recently, and he's an amazing drummer. But the first time I worked with him was on My Love of Country. A lot of this record, you know, was because I have also known David Mansfield for quite a long time, but not as a producer and until My Love of Country. It was such an amazing experience and he did such an incredible job that this was sort of the follow on from that. You know, I just couldn't wait to work with him again on my own songs. And so we used, you know, basically the same rhythm section because it was such a pleasure before.
Let me play some of the bridge. It's a very sort of Beatles, a lot of seventh chords, maybe half a measure at the end. And you thought about your constructing bridges. Certainly that could have been much longer, but it's a very nice, concise thing.
I wouldn't even consider that a bridge in this song. To me, this song doesn't really have a bridge. It's almost like that's a chorus, really. There's almost sort of a first part of the song and then a second part of the song. And the second part is kind of a verse and a chorus, I think. Yeah, I don't think that really is a bridge. But I'm so bad at analyzing these things. I'm not that type of musician. And I don't, maybe it's because I also don't have musical training. You know, I don't really look at songs. I don't hear their structure. It's not the first thing I think of. I have to really delve in and look at it. And a lot of the time I don't really look at what I'm doing because yes, I'm lazy and don't have that bedrock of musical theory, but also because I don't like to analyze these things too much because I find it messes with my creativity. If I'm thinking too much about form and what, oh, isn't it interesting that I'm doing a half bar here and you know, is this a bridge or is this a B section? So I kind of leave all that stuff to later on when we get into the studio and then hope that the musicians really, I'm guided by them a lot. I like to also let the musicians be good musicians that they are and not have me dictate too much what they should do. And again, if you're lucky enough to have a good producer, which is so rare, which I did these days, is just also to lean on David, who came up with a lot of these things. And then some things I did have. I mean, I think I did have that section where I drop a bar. It's kind of up to him to make that real, you know, make that definite, make that good, make that intentional, you know, like, and the band too.
Well, I think you end up with interesting rhythmic stuff, and, you know, this can even apply to the other musical elements, but if you're paying attention to your whims, right? Whether it's something in the lyric itself, as, you know, we were talking about with the other song, or just, you know, I was, again, hearing this sort of as a character of the two hits coming in, that as if, so you're not thinking, you know, like you're a drummer and, oh, I have to add an extra thing. Like, well, that's weird and unnatural. But if you're approaching this as a singer, you know, you could have any number of, you know.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. I mean, I approach the songs as the singer and the writer, and I just want to do what I want to do. You know, I want to feel the way I want it to feel. And often that involves doing something that's not, you know, strictly the rhythm, you know, or that's not strictly in the time signature even, you know, we have to move around a lot, or we have to add a piece or take a piece away to sort of convey it the way I want to convey it. And then, you know, as I say, it's up to the producer and the musicians to sort of translate that to their world. But the great thing is, when you work with really good people, you know, when you work with really good drummers, they never say, well, that's not, you know, well, whether you're dropping a, you know, there should be another bar there, or there should be, let's finish that phrase and then do that. They never say that because they're in the service of the song. And so you can see their wheels turning, like, okay, how do I make that work with what I'm playing? Or how do I find a cool way to do what he wants to do?
Yeah, I guess the extreme of that would be like the bridge for Bohemian Rhapsody or something like that. That seems like something that at this point would be more likely that you would get something that crazy just jabbering into a phone than like sitting down. And, you know, once you get a guitar even in your hand, then it's something becomes regular in a way that it's that some of the, I feel, you know, I was in a composition school a little bit, took some classes in college, and in trying to write these things, it's really just let your mind do these frantic things that,
yeah,
and then figure it out afterward, you know. So it's not thinking in terms of music theory. I agree with you that actually I've never been in the position of knowing music theory so well that I'm like, okay, now I'm switching to an Aeolian, you know, apart from obvious things like triplets or whatever, you know. Well, let's move on to the second song here, which also has some rhythmic hiccups in it, but a very different tone. Move at Speed, the closing track from Heartbreaker Please. I'm a sucker for closing tracks. I really like Same Old Song from the new record, just because it's weirder. I don't know.
Yeah, but I'm a big fan of the closing track too. It's usually a slow one.
Yeah, so say a little where you're at with this 2020 Heartbreaker Please and this song before we hear it.
Oh man, Move at Speed. Yeah, I like this one. I can't remember it too well because as we've covered, it was 6 years ago. But this was recorded anyway in a slightly less organized fashion, in the sense that Heartbreaker Please was a bit more just me. I was producing it myself. And so it was slightly more shambolic and slightly more a case of me. I'm pretty sure I just played the song to a click track and then we added stuff afterwards. I don't even remember the rhythmic quirks, you know, like if there's like, if it's three or four, you know. I think I just do it differently.
So when you play it now, it doesn't even do this exactly, or are you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it might be one of these. I'm not sure I've played this with a band, and maybe there's a reason for that, because it would require some analysis that I'm not willing to undergo.
Let's hear it.
Hold the baby on your, like you mean it, like you care. Fight the feeling to be free. You ain't going anywhere. When you move at speed, there is no release. When you move at speed, leave the pieces on the floor. You will never have control. Only leaves you wanting more. You are running yourself when you move at speed, there is no relief. When you move at speed.
Yeah, so I could see that even though there's, you know, we're sort of starting in three, two, on your knees, and then you have like extra beat, but it's still the fact that it's a click, the fact that it's 1-2-1, it's really a 2-4, right? It's really just band to dun to, you know, and then you can just add individual measures willy nilly.
I would say so, yeah. And I think that just adding or not adding one after a vocal phrase, because it's all about the singing for me. So it just, sometimes it felt natural to have a beat after what I'd just sung before the chorus, and sometimes it didn't. And I wasn't really sure what I was doing. But I quite like the beat. I quite like the, I think, I'm pretty sure it's chopped up. You know, I think it's a loop. It's just the kick and the crash, basically. It sounds quite good.
You said you played most of this yourself. That means you're playing the drums yourself, or this was a drum machine?
I meant that I just played the, you know, I sat and played guitar and sang to a click, and then we had a drummer come up with something that was, you know, worked. But it's basically a loop.
Yeah, well, specifically, like, the little open hi-hat seems to... So was that a drummer idea, or is that a you idea, as far as you recall? I know this was...
I think it was probably one of those things where it's a bit of a combination, when I can't even remember who played on this. But I think it's probably, you know, the drummer came in, and then we, you know, we were just trying a few things. And then when he hit on it, so to speak, literally... I would say, oh, yeah, something like that. Oh, I like that. And then we'd just refine it together.
Zach Jones, it looks like.
Zach Jones, of course, yes. Zach Jones is great, yeah.
Well, you got another synth solo here. So I guess not quite as crazy as the John Grant thing, but a nice little moving thing. Is that, what's the origin of that?
That's a New York guy called Eric Finland, who's a wonderful player and, yes, slightly more traditional. He's not as synthy as a John Grant, let's say, and more of a sort of blues and soul guy. I remember wanting a sound that was not too stock in that world, you know, something that was a little bit more edgy and not, you know, a classic soul B3 or something, you know, and not something that lived in a particular genre.
Well, and I really liked it. Not only is there that nice little pure lead solo, but you have kind of a stereo wash, a syntho seething around in the background, I guess just to make it sound like the keyboard belongs in that setting, that if you just put it starkly on top of the guitars, maybe it would stand out in some weird way. I don't know.
I can't remember that. Yeah.
Okay.
I can't remember if that was an idea. There's sometimes that stuff is in mixing, you know, where you sort of find some extra piece and you go, oh, that would be cool if we just had that in the background there. Maybe even something you didn't use originally. I've definitely had that experience. When you're trying to make things sound cohesive, you know, that may have been an example of, yeah, is that sound a bit too jarring on its own? Maybe we could make it sit in there a bit nicer.
Okay. So, yes, I see that the internet is telling me that you produced this one yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, is it significant? Does it feel significantly different when you had David Mansfield? I mean, it seems like he was just a partner that you were making decisions with. Whereas in this one, well, you still have a band. You still have, you know, people that are playing. Because we're not in the days of the producer, like, oh, we got to make this a radio hit, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's not that. No, but it is significantly different. I am not a producer in that sense. What I've done for myself and a couple of other people is sort of what I call, you know, the producer with the crossword puzzle, you know, and the cigar who's just making decisions, you know, who basically is doing no engineering and no arranging. Because I don't have those skills. So there's been some good producers who do just that, who basically just have the ear to say, yes, no, no, yeah, let's try this. And they rely on the musicians to do the musicianing and the engineer to do the engineering. But when you have someone like David Mansfield, it's a whole different kettle of fish and it's elevated. He does have musical training and he can write arrangements and he can do string arrangements and horn arrangements. And he has the knowledge to do that, you know, at the highest level, which is fantastic. It's also, you know, a shifting of responsibility, which is a real joy for the artist, too, is to have somebody else being in charge of not the boring stuff, but the mundane stuff, so that you can just be the artist, just be the singer. Like, do you want to think about backing up hard drives and things like that? Nah, not really. And do you want to think about, you know, the tech stuff and the engineering stuff and why that kick drum doesn't sound right? No, you'd prefer to have somebody else who's overseeing that from the beginning, who has that, you know, so he's listening for that stuff from the beginning, which I've tried to do in things where I am the producer, but you know, you have to be paying attention to the sort of global sound of it, and from the beginning that's taking up a lot of energy, and so it's very freeing not to have to do that.
Yes, I have the setup to record drums in my home and things, but I don't want to spend the hour and a half miking it up and getting everything to actually work and rather just have people that do this for a living.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in producing this yourself, so some of the little, like there's a little very nice high piano note kind of thing that is coming into the background here and there in this song, which certainly sounds like something you could have done yourself, but do you touch a keyboard on any of your albums?
Do I touch a keyboard? Probably not, really, unless it's an emergency, unless it's something that we've forgotten to do. And at the very last minute, I can touch a high note. But no, I think that was probably played. I think I probably asked for that from Eric at the time. Yeah.
Are you always writing on guitar, or do you have a piano somewhere? Like, what it seems like usually there's a piano growing up. And so you always at least learn to play, you know, you mess around, or is that not part of your...
No, I didn't have that, actually. There was no piano growing up, and no piano in the house now. Yeah, I don't have any piano skills. I can block some chords, but that's not very useful.
Well, let me play the bit right after that synth solo. You know, we've got the nice little piano thing, and it adds an extra synth doing these kind of one-note things.
And speak, there is no...
I don't even recall. I'm not even sure that sounds like a piano to me, or maybe it's a very...
Well, there's a piano already, but then there's an added keyboard on top of that.
Pretty atmospheric, pretty bay in echo or reverb or whatever. But no, I don't recall that. Well, you know, again, it's the fun of having other musicians come in and play is that they play good stuff. So very often, if you have someone come in for a session, and let's say we wanted, I can't remember if this was the case on this, I don't think we tracked, I think he came in. So I think it probably is the case of usually, like, it'd be great to have you do a solo on this, but obviously while you, like, it'd be nice to have some other stuff too. And so sometimes it's the case where just a good musician comes in and they'll do a couple of tracks and they'll say, let me try a bit of this, you know, and they'll do something that maybe seems simple at the time and maybe something you're not even looking for in the moment, but then when you come to mix it and look at what they've done, they often hear something that you don't hear that's missing or that might be great. And sometimes it's something like that that's in a register that sounds like it should be there and maybe isn't to them. So you might be in there working on something like da 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 da, and they'll come in with fresh ears and be like, oh, that's cool, but you know, there's this huge gap in the higher register where nothing's happening, and you know, maybe you're going for that, but maybe I should put something in there and maybe you might use it later. So I think that might have been what happened here.
Well, I know even when I'm watching a band, if I'm into it, I want to sing harmony. So if you're working with a producer that is a singer, or it seems like in both these songs, we're going to have some a little backing vocals on the third song we'll talk about. But in both these songs, you have resisted. No one will sing over me. I will not double myself. Is that just because of, you know, the particulars of this? If I'm even remembering Comeback correctly, I don't think there were any, you know, you could, with that very, very stark chorus, like, could have stacked some stuff or something. Any thought about when you do and don't draw on that?
Usually it just sort of, the song dictates it to me. I haven't had too many instances of wondering whether I should or not. Almost all of the time, it seems plain what I'm going to add them or not. And then, you know, some of the songs where you don't add them like that, it's about the delivery of the song and the lyrical intent that it seems like it should be just one voice. But then often, you know, you do try and fill that sonic space, the register where backing vocals might be, with something else. So it's not totally empty. So there's a lot of atmospheric sounds on Come Back that are probably in the register of what might be a harmony vocal. But instead of that, we've opted for those sounds.
Now, one other thing I noticed in this, it seems like when you wrap up the chorus, maybe it does it slightly differently each time. Let me just play the end of the first one. This is about 45 seconds.
When you move at speed.
So we just have bum, bum. We're going to just get off the minor chord for just one passing chord. And then if I remember correctly, the last time it happens twice. So it seems like you're changing this up a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's different every time. I thought that was part of songwriting somehow. Mm-hmm. I somehow took that on board that you're supposed to vary the, you know, the ends of verses or the ends of choruses a little bit. Yeah, I think it just became a habit of doing that a lot of the time because it seems like a good technique to make it interesting. And to, again, it's usually dictated by the vocal. You know, I feel like you want to give some variation in the way you sing it, mm-hmm, to keep the ear interested. And then very often it seems like the thing to do if you just change the chord underneath, you know, you make it, as you say, just a passing chord one time and then a full bar or a full couple of beats the next time, it just catches the ear nicely.
Yes. So to wrap up the song, you've got basically a double chorus. Let me try to play the end of the first half. So we're going to add a whole extra line. Moving to that major chord really opens it up. And likewise, the way it ends, I won't play that for the folks, but that you actually, like, let's actually play the, instead of just resolving it with one beat, we're going to play a whole measure, bum, bum, dun, you know, some, I think it's four count for each of the, I don't know if you have anything to add to what you already said, but I think you've sort of covered it.
No, I mean, kind of same thing. You know, I don't even know what I'm doing there. I don't even know what the count is or how long I'm leaving unless I listen to it and figured it out. I'm just trying to do something that is emotionally impactful and sounds good to my ear. You know, it's some kind of combination. It's pop music. So to me, it's some kind of combination of repetition and variation.
Sure.
These two seemingly opposing ideas working together is kind of what makes a great song for me a lot of the time. You want to hear the chorus again, but you want it to be a little bit different. And you want to hear maybe a double chorus, but you at the end, maybe do you? But if you're going to, you might need to, you know, have the turnaround be something a little bit more creative. But it's all in service of trying to get across the emotion of the song, I think.
Well, and doing that all at least makes me feel less guilty about using regular major chords. It seems like we're pulling out what we're going to have bass and drums and guitar. And it's not like the guitar is using a crazy new sound that nobody's ever heard of. You know, you're using traditional materials. So if you don't have some nuance and personalization to it, then what is the point? What, you know, why add this to the world?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we're not reinventing the wheel with any new instruments or new chords or new notes. It's the same stuff. So you're trying to, yes, make it something that's yours and just a little bit different.
Well, let's move to the third song. Going back in your career to your second, third album, Separate Ways, 2006. I Should Get Up. This is one of the singles on Spotify, you know, that would, it would keep thrusting me this at me after it would play whatever I had intended to listen to. Yeah. Any thought about this era, this song before we hear it?
Oh man, it seems like so long ago to me. I'm always, you know, faintly horrified by hearing anything that I've done. You know, the older it is, the more scary it is, because I sound like somebody else, which I was. I was somebody else. I was somebody young and different. And, but it very often sounds just kind of immature. I cringe a little bit, but it's like, you know, I would explain it to non-musicians as like listening to the sound of your recorded voice multiplied by 100. You know, if you hate the way you you sound when somebody plays your voice back to you, imagine what it's like hearing you sing a song for 3.5 minutes when 20 years ago when you were naive and different. But so I think it's a good song though. I mean, I guess the test is that I still play that song because I think it's quite good. It has a good chorus, a good bridge. It's elevated immeasurably by having the great Richard Thompson, my dad, playing the guitar. So I'm grateful for that.
Depression looms, I'm such a miserable fool. Stay in bed, I don't want to go to school. But I see the sun is beating down. There's no excuses from the clouds. And I should get up, I should go.
The obviously the Richard Thompson inimitable guitar licks. Do you recall when you were doing this? Is it first take with him? What was the circumstance in which you were, how much of his time was he, were you getting involved here?
Yeah. Well, you never need very long, which is he's very good at that. And I definitely picked that up from him. I hate spending time on anything. I like things to be quick. You know, I do remember this because actually those first licks are not him. I think he's just playing solo. So it's another great, lovely guitar player that I was very close to back then called Jason Krigler. But I do remember then, you know, wanting him to play the solo. And I don't remember this song things up. But I remember going to California to a studio near his house, you know, of someone we didn't know, but it was convenient. And we rented this studio for, you know, 3 hours. And I remember him playing on this, and it was great and very quick. But then what I really remember is he played on another track on this record, a song called No Way to Be, which is a very slow ballad, which also features the great Garth Hudson, which it's worth checking out, not so much for me, but for the great sure. players on the track.
I will link folks to it, yeah.
Yeah, so what I remember is actually that track. So he did the solo on this song very quickly. It was great, like, okay. And then I said, oh, maybe, you know, that went so quickly. I wasn't planning this, but maybe you could just play a bit on this one too. And No Way to Be is sort of is a long, you know, 5 minute song. And Garth Hudson was already on it playing the organ. And I said, well, do you want to listen to it first? And he went, no, just play it. And so we played the song, and he'd never heard it before. And he played from the beginning all the way through to the end once, and that's what's on the record. And it's some of the greatest stuff I've ever heard him play.
So now I was thinking it was the, just because I'm expecting to hear his riffs, and these things at the beginning sound very much in the style I would expect from a Richard Thompson record, but yet it's a different guy. So burn on me. I also noticed there's audible guitar amp buzz at the beginning. Which is, I don't know, maybe at this point, yeah, of course, the technology was still there that you can, you know, you can remove that.
I don't think we were trying to keep it. I just think it was, you know, oh shit, it's there. And my memory is, you know, still, it was 20 years ago. I don't know if the technology was good enough to take it out and have it still sound good. So let's leave it in.
That's been an issue for me in a few albums of, like, you know, I have a guitarist.
Oh, it's been an issue since the beginning of recorded music. How do we get that fucking amp to be quiet?
Well, and maybe you don't care. Maybe it adds to the grit.
It does. I embrace it now. It actually sounds great to me.
Who is the producer on this one?
It's me and a guy called Brad Albetta, who was really just the engineer and kind of a friend. And we started making it, and I didn't have a record label or a producer, and we ended up just sort of working on it together. And I think the production credit is both of us.
Let me play some of the bridge here. So this, we do get some harmony vocals come in on the end of each chorus. There's some kind of bed of guitars with a lot of chorus on it and synths, and I can't even, like, really make out everything, but it's you know, it's a very nicely produced little bed. Any memories of that?
No, it's too long. I have okay. No idea what's going on there. There's definitely, yeah, it's probably a combination of spacey guitars and keyboards. I think I hear a keyboard thing that's playing some, you know, that's playing. It's not that dissimilar to the song you played that's 20 years later that has the keyboard thing.
Well, that's
with
what
the
one
note. Maybe that's a trick I keep repeating. That's pretty common thing to try, especially in bridges, is to just sort of go for an atmospheric bed, as you say.
Well, and the way you wrap that up, that no one misses the quiet kid, and the quiet kid is the sore. It's not the quiet part. It is the,
yeah.
I mean, was that intentional irony, or that's just the way it sort of wrapped up?
I think that's just the way okay. it came out. I don't know why. I don't think there was too much intent there.
The way this chorus is structured here, let me just play one of them. For instance, just, you know, that you repeat the thing, should get up, should get up, should get up. And then the third one sort of tricks the rhythm a little bit, just to, you know, not that we're adding extra drum beats, but just vocally. Any thought about that at this point? I mean, it's catchy.
I guess the third time the vocal goes into the verse section, you know, it hangs over into the verse section. I've never even thought about it just until you've forced me to analyze it. I admire people that have all of the knowledge and can still be creative and do something different. But as we've discussed, I am not that person. So I lean heavily on all the things I don't know to allow me to do something that maybe is not typical.
when you end the song, again, we sort of have a double chorus, but the fact that something unexpected is happening for me there, that I should go out. It doesn't sound like, and now we're doing another chorus. It just sounds like a continuation, and that you could say up and out in any sort of order.
I think maybe, yeah, just again, the double chorus. I think just the turnaround. I think I'm singing the same thing, but over a different chord, which sounds quite meaningful, sounds quite good. In order to do it twice, the chord that I hit under the vocal that's the same, I haven't hit before, I think, mm-hmm. is what happens yeah. there. So, and it just sounds pleasing to the ear. I certainly didn't invent it. But when I played it, I was like, oh yeah, that sounds good to me.
Let's play the very end of the song here. So we've resolved to a kind of minor here. A very concise song, right? This hits 3 minutes. Move at Speed was not even 3 minutes. You know, once you've sort of gotten there, like, well, you could sit there and have more guitar solo or more, you know, any thought about, no, it's just gotta, we're just gonna wrap it there.
The music that I was raised on, that I was really into, was from the age of the 2.5 minute pop song. Basically, American 50s music was what I was obsessed with. So it was, you know, Chuck Berry and the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly, and all those songs were necessarily short, and that's the way they did it. And I think whatever you is formative for you, i.e. the first music that you're enamored by that gets you into music, I think that really sticks with you and is a sort of bedrock for what you do, or a framework for what you do. So yeah, I most of the time that's how I hear songs when I'm writing. I want them to be concise. I'm trying to, you know, follow that model of writing something that's really short and to the point, but well crafted and hopefully emotionally impactful, maybe even funny in certain moments with a clever turn of phrase, and try and squeeze it and then do a bridge and go somewhere new and then get back from the bridge in a satisfying way to the chorus and maybe do it twice and get out in a couple of minutes. And that's what I was raised on, and that's what I hear mostly.
Well, this song reminded me, one of my favorite bands, Crowded House, which I know has sort of a direct genetic link to, I saw Richard Thompson opening for them in 93, and they've played together, and your version of Persuasion, probably my favorite Tim Finn tune, with you doing that with your dad is wonderful. So clearly that was in the genetics, but I didn't know if this was sort of a Crowded House influence thing, or you just have, you're both referencing the 50s.
I think probably a bit of both. Yeah, as you say, I think they were probably influenced by that. They're probably a bit more adventurous than I am as writers, you know, as far as form and certainly lyrics. But I was a big fan of Crowded House. I'm not really sure which came first, but, you know, my dad was on the same label as them and had some connections and same producer. And so they did some touring together. I think I was already aware of them because they were really the first band that I liked that were contemporary, because, you know, to my ear, since being raised on all the things I've just told you and old fashioned American pop music from the mid 50s, the music that I was hearing in the charts in the mid 80s when I was in England, I just thought was, didn't compare. I couldn't get on board with any of it. That just sounded terrible to
me. No Wang Chung for you? No.
No, none of that. No. I couldn't believe how bad Top of the Pops was every week, you know, compared to a Buddy Holly song. It just didn't stack up. And then Crowded House came along, and was probably a little bit older too, so I was maturing a little bit. They were a beacon for me of, oh, wow, there's decent contemporary music. And then, you know, it was really just by coincidence that my dad had some affiliation with them or some connection with them. And then I got to go and see them a couple of times because of that. And they were so great live. So it was really a lovely piece of my musical journey.
Well, I guess if the song has the energy that I associate with them, you know, again, did not go overboard on the harmonies. There's a little harmony in here, but it's really just that one little effect. It's not what's, oh, there's happiness going on. Let's layer, which I tend to just do by default.
This has come up a lot for me on this record, but I think all the way through, it's so much of it is just taste, you know, so much of music of what's good and what's, you know, that's a subjective thing, but yeah, it's just what your taste is. And I think my taste is an exercise in leaving things out, really. and being judicious about the few things that you do put in. And, you know, and then the people that you find that you have the same taste as you probably are similar.
Sure. And vocal confidence can certainly have something to do with it, that even at this early stage, and maybe you're cringing at your vocal performance, but the little falsetto, that something I can't do with it, like, sounds great. You know, any thought about sort of the evolution of your voice over the years? Are you satisfied with your status as crooner now as opposed to then? Or, because obviously you've done these dual vocal things let's do a harmony with an Emmylou Harris sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think you make a good point in that maybe the decisions that you make regarding backing vocals, whether to use them or not, does have a lot to do with how confident you are with your own voice, i.e. with your lead vocal, and if do you feel like you're a singer. And I think that was always what I had that was the strongest thing, as I was a singer, so I felt pretty good about being out there on my own, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, the evolution of the voice, of the singing voice, is interesting. I mean, it's something that you don't really have any control over, and it's something that ages just like the rest of your body. So it's kind of a weird, you know, it's just a sort of lifelong negotiation. And I guess the difference with the rest of the aging process is that you're trying to hit the same notes as you've always hit a lot of the time,
sure.
But you're not a kid anymore. And everybody gets a different lifespan of their voice, and you have no idea what that's going to be, what the quality is going to be. You don't know if you're going to be Paul McCartney or, you know, somebody whose voice craps out after a couple of years. You have no way of telling, and some of it is maintenance and taking care of yourself, but some of it's just luck of the draw. And I mean, I've been pretty happy. I thought my voice was a bit weak and cringy when I was young. It's been pretty good for the last 10 or 15 years. I felt pretty good about what I hear when it goes by again. I think I'm just getting to the age now, I'm 50 now, where I can feel it not being quite as strong in certain areas. Some of it maybe being things like falsetto gets weaker as you age. And then it just becomes a question of, okay, let's negotiate with your voice. How are you going to deal with this? Are you going to try and sing it exactly the same as you did when you were 20, or exactly the same as it is on the record, where you had 10 tries to hit that note? Or are you going to maybe
probably punched in just for that line?
Maybe, yeah, that certainly happens. So, yeah, you just have to decide who you're going to be, and if you can, and I think it's just going to continue. You know, every time you sing a song, you might get to it, a song you haven't sung for a couple of years, and be like, oh, I don't know if I can hit that note anymore. I might have to approach it differently.
Is vocal maintenance something you've been very technical and medical about, you know, being conscious of, I want to retain this? I mean, did you take voice lessons to start, or was it just as intuitive as the guitar work?
I didn't do voice lessons or training, and I haven't been careful about maintaining my voice in any way, shape, or form until, you know, maybe the last 5-10 years. But that's also lifestyle. I mean, you're not going out after the show so much anymore. And
no more smoke in the bars.
No more smoke in the bars does help. So, yeah, I haven't been particularly careful about it, but that's also, it's the same as everything else, right? The aging process, even if you're not a singer, it's like you don't really miss it until it's gone, you know? So when things start to crack or sag or whatever it is, you're like, oh, shit, let me pay more attention to that and work on it and try to hold on to what I've got. I try to be kind to my voice now.
Do you have a consistent band that you play live with, or are you not trying to play live very much? You know, I see you have things on the calendar, but is it sort of this stretch of dates, I will get people together in this, or do you have some of these folks that you mentioned, Tony or Charlie, that you said you'd played with for quite a while? They're coming back again and again and feel like this is your band.
No, I wouldn't say so. I've never really been that, because I've been solo since the beginning. I've never been in a band, and I've never really had a set band or a set group of guys that I played with for long periods, just different tours, you know. And some of those guys come back over and over again for certain periods of your life, you know, doing the same tours. But yeah, no, just a revolving cast. And then, but also, you know, I play solo a lot. Mm-hmm. That's the way to make a living. You know, I mean, when you find someone great, it's nice to have them around, but it's also nice to play with different people. So that's a fun part of the dynamic, is having new players.
Do you feel like the thing that you're most excited about in doing music is getting out and playing those shows, whether solo, or is it building the new batch of songs and getting it perfect? And then, you know, that's the thing that is going to be your legacy.
both things are enjoyable. They seem so separate, you know, because it's such a cycle. So you're either doing one, you're either writing the songs and you're, you know, and that's what you're doing, and you're in that space. And then it gets really exciting to go and record them and to have them come alive. And once you've done that, that seems like ages ago to me. And so you're thinking about playing them live, and that becomes what's exciting. So it is nice to be able to have those separate phases of the process. But I do look forward to playing. I sort of wish I could stay home and not have to travel, because travel is such a pain. But once I get on the stage, I'm usually pretty into it.
I just a couple of days ago discovered the Thompson album, Family, which you, I guess, initiated. So there's just these things. And I knew that you had helped your mother with her sort of comeback album and sang a song that I can point folks to. Any thought about it, just how you're fitting these different projects together, how it all comes? I mean, you were talking about long periods of doing nothing, but are you having to produce to fill time, or how do these things sort of measure out to fill out your life?
Just writing and recording my own music is, I'm not prolific enough and to have that be the only thing that fills my time. So it's nice to have other projects to do in between, you know, like the country record or a family thing in between to give me more time to write those 10 songs that I need. So it also makes you appreciate the different things. You know, it's nice to, it makes you, singing covers is really a pleasure because there's less angst involved. But then once you've done that, you're really keen to get back to your own songs, and it makes you appreciate how enjoyable that is. And, you know, working with family is really fun. And then it becomes, you know, you're like, why am I doing this? And then you can't wait to get away from them and get back to yourself. So, but that's, you know, it's just like everything. It's nice to have some variation in the things that we do. So it's a nice balance to have.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of production myself, engineering somebody else's albums, and it was all many years ago, but it was, okay, this is getting to be to use my equipment and getting me in some habits to work on my own stuff. But I sure wish I was working on my own stuff instead of this.
Mm. Yeah.
Not a long-term solution. Well, thanks so much for chatting. It's been a pleasure listening through your catalog.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, to say goodbye, we're going to play the new single. This is Heartache, again, from the new album, Never Be the Same. Do you have a few words about it before we send people off?
Oh, well, this is kind of the most stylized song. Again, I wasn't intending it to be this, but it's pretty Staxy, let's say, sort of soul. The horns are really, really are Stax inspired. So, you know, hopefully it's, it sounds like me and not an impersonation of anybody. The gist of the song is, you know, it's deja vu all over again, to quote Yogi Berra.
I will link folks to some of your cover versions, right? I was just listening to the What's Going On, the actual soul song that you covered during the pandemic, I guess. Yeah, nice variety of stuff. All right, here it is. Yes, the most 50s-ish or 60s-ish of the tunes. So this is Heartache.
So this is Heartache. I've heard about it. I know a thing or two best. Is it any wonder they sing about it? It's your whole world in on itself. She's gone for good this time. heartache all over again. So this is heartache all over again.
Thanks so much to Teddy. Such a wonderful voice, such a great sense of melody. Hear more of him at teddythompson.net. He's also got a couple more whimsical recordings at teddythompson.bandcamp.com, including that Pandemic Emergency Coverage EP, which is him singing covers. You can learn more about this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Now, the blog post for this episode there includes links to some of the other songs by Teddy that we mentioned. It has a link to Teddy and Richard singing the song Persuasion together. That is my favorite Tim Finn tune. He wrote it with Richard on that tour that I mentioned. So I love Richard's version that features Teddy. I love Tim's version. I also want to mention, right, Linda Thompson, his mother, has not been with Richard Thompson for a long time. She had a reemergence album very recently that Teddy had a lot to do with. She has vocal issues, so she can't sing her own songs, so he sings one. So I've linked to that from the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. There's also a trailer for the Family album attributed just to Thompson. So it's some tunes by Teddy, some tunes by Richard, some tunes by Linda, and other people in the family. I should mention that that introductory song, In My Arms, that started off this episode, also features Rufus Wainwright, right? I've had Loudon Wainwright on this show, and that's another good father-son plus siblings, I don't want to say act because they don't do that much together, but a legacy. I've recorded two more interviews since this one. The first with Michael Timmins of Cowboy Junkies. He's their main songwriter, one of three siblings in the band. I think if you like Teddy, you'll also like Cowboy Junkies. Then I just talked to Bruce Sword from Pineapple Thief, a contemporary, I want to say progressive rock, but he's also very smooth, tuneful, has a voice not terribly unlike Teddy's. Also a British guy. So Bruce is promoting his new solo album. His band Pineapple Thief has for the past decade featured Gavin Harrison, who is one of the King Crimson drummers and is truly amazing. So you'll want to stick around for both those interviews and the other great ones that I have lined up for this summer. Make sure you're subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music feed via nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or better yet, get your experience entirely ad-free, which you can do in two ways. If you're listening to Apple Podcasts right now, there should be a subscribe button. You just click that and you start paying me a little bit per month and you get this podcast and two of my others ad-free for that fee. Or you could just go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. That, in addition to the ad-free feed, also gets you my detailed episode notes that break down the structure of the songs, give you the lyrics, a nice thing to read along with. And in either case, you are signaling that you want this podcast to continue. I also want to encourage you, if you like the show, go to the Apple Podcasts or Spotify page for this. Leave a nice rating and review. There's a little widget that leads you through the review process in the upper right corner of nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. All right, I'm very excited right now. I'm about to leave for my son's wedding this weekend, and I'll get to play a little music with my daughter at one of the events. Right, speaking of fathers and sons doing music together, in fact, my son has been jamming with me on bass on and off this spring. Can I get the family band together? Well, maybe to play for other family members at holidays. We'll see if anything more comes of it. I hope you are being creative in whatever way you see fit, experiencing new music, experiencing new emotions. However you're doing it, keep on musicking. Till next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.